Welcome to the 44th episode of Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Brandon Scalia. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Onc Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. We recently traveled to New York City for a State of the Science Summit on ovarian cancer. During the meeting, the faculty shared their insight on the various surgical and medical treatment modalities in advanced ovarian cancer, as well as investigational interventions that may further define standards of care. Prior to the start of the summit, we sat down with Chair Mario M. Lateo Jr., MD, FACOG, FACS, who is the Fellowship Director of Gynecologic Service and Director of the Minimal Access and Robotic Surgery Program in the Department of Surgery at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Lateo plainly stated that surgery is still considered a vital part of initial therapy for patients with advanced ovarian cancer, but the current debate is the timing of the procedure as well as the role of neoadjuvant chemotherapy. In our interview, Lateo provides insight into the decision-making process for determining the placement of surgery in patients with newly diagnosed advanced ovarian cancer, as well as the use of hypothermic intraperitoneal chemotherapy.
At our institution, we still do favor a primary debulking approach, and there's a flowchart that we kind of use in our head to decide who will have surgery. There's a few criteria that would make us offer neoadjuvant chemotherapy first, and that's usually in patients who are older, more than 70 years of age, who have widespread metastatic disease, and who have a less than optimal performance status, or who have a very low albumin. So if any patient meets all three of those criteria, elderly with extensive disease and either a low albumin or a high ASA score, those patients are routinely offered primarily neoadjuvant chemotherapy to start. And then if they don't meet those criteria, then we'll look at the disease distribution on the CAT scan. There are certain situations where it's obvious on a CAT scan that a complete cell reduction is not possible, and that's somewhat surgeon dependent. And then also we make sure the patient's medically fit for surgery. So a patient who is sick, someone who's had a recent pulmonary embolism, someone we think we wouldn't be able to undergo an extensive surgery, we will often offer them neoadjuvant chemotherapy first. But then everyone else is a candidate for primary debulking. So interval debulking is essentially what would happen in someone who undergoes neoadjuvant chemotherapy. So there's always, surgery is still considered an important part of the initial therapy for patients. The debate is now the timing of the surgery. Is it before the chemotherapy or is it after three cycles of chemotherapy? So all patients will have some surgery at some point. At our institution, at most places. Unfortunately, there's a small percentage of patients who may never get to surgery, either because they're too sick, too old, or they don't have a good response or progress while on their initial chemotherapy.
Next, we sat down with Paul Sabatini, MD, Deputy Physician in Chief for Clinical Research at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Sabatini explained that historically, the decision of whether to use frontline bevacizumab, intraperitoneal chemotherapy, and chemotherapy as a weekly dose-dense regimen or on a three-week dosing schedule in patients with newly diagnosed ovarian cancer has been clouded by a series of conflicting clinical trials. However, in the modern treatment era, those questions are now being put to rest, allowing researchers to focus their efforts on additive combinations with greater activity, said Sabatini. In our interview, Sabatini clarifies where the field stands with the use of these modalities in the frontline setting of newly diagnosed ovarian cancer.
So we look tonight at how frontline therapy has evolved over the last few years, and we've looked at several different modalities, intraperitoneal therapy, the addition of antivascular therapies, and changing the dosing schedule of frontline therapy. I think we've come to a place where we have decided that from randomized studies, there doesn't appear to be a particular advantage with the intraperitoneal delivery of chemotherapy. There was a really robust advantage to weekly chemotherapy in the Japanese GOG study, but this looked a bit less in the subsequent GOG study, and in the current ICON-8 study, there doesn't seem to be a particular advantage for weekly therapy over three-weekly therapy. And I think what this tells me, at least, is that we can choose either a three-weekly backbone or a weekly backbone in which to add the multiple new novel therapies that should be explored. So we're now exploring PARP inhibitors, we're exploring antivascular therapies, we're exploring anti-PD-1 drugs. And I think we've, in my mind, have really settled on what are optimal doses and schedules that can be used to add these novel compounds and that we should move forward. The push for intraperitoneal therapy in ovarian cancer was really because the disease is largely confined to the peritoneal cavity, and there was also a lot of interest in high-dose therapy. Some people also think intraperitoneal therapy might work because of its stimulation from an immunotherapeutic standpoint of the peritoneal cavity. But I think what we've really shown as time goes on is that intraperitoneal delivery can give similar outcomes. And despite the fact that the NCI put an alert to say everyone should have this in 2006, the uptake was very, very low, largely based on the technical expertise required to give it and the toxicity when it was delivered. Well, the antivascular story has been interesting in ovarian cancer. The addition of bevacizumab up front, which is approved in Europe and was recently approved in the United States, to date seems to deliver for all comers a modest progression-free survival advantage of about 4 months. In subsets of patients with stage 4 disease, patients with suboptimal debulking, or patients with ascites, there appears to be a modest overall survival advantage in those subsets. So I think those might be the particular patients who might want to consider bevacizumab up front. Other patients might not, and certainly there is utility of bevacizumab later in the disease course.
In terms of medical therapies, PARP inhibitors have emerged as primary treatment and maintenance therapy for select patients with recurrent ovarian cancer. Although three PARP inhibitors have FDA indications as monotherapy in the maintenance setting for this patient population, investigators are working to extend their benefit to more subgroups and determine their added efficacy when used in combination, explained Chris Ann Shi, MD, a medical oncologist at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center.
So it's a really exciting time to be in GI medical oncology. The climate is such that we're moving towards molecularly targeted treatments, and in particular, the focus of my talk is PARP inhibitors in recurrent ovarian cancers. And since 2013, there's been an advent of FDA approvals, both for treatment and maintenance of PARP inhibitors. Rucaparib is approved in the treatment setting for patients with both either germline or somatic mutations, with patients who have had greater or equal to 2 treatment prior lines, and olaparib is approved in the setting of germline mutations as well, BRCA positive patients in the treatment setting. I then also go into topics of maintenance therapy that are currently approved in the recurrent setting. Three drugs are currently approved olaparib, niraparib, and rucaparib, all irregardless of BRCA mutational status, and in the recurrent setting after complete or partial response to platinum therapies. Another exciting part of this is with SOLO-1, the introduction of PARP inhibitors in the frontline maintenance setting, where patients with either BRCA somatic or germline mutations have the opportunity to be treated in the maintenance setting with PARP inhibitors. In terms of moving forward, what I see is focusing our efforts and our research with regard to how to incorporate PARP inhibitors into the treatment schema of a patient's treatment course. Thinking about patient, not only in patient selection, but also thinking of methods and mechanisms of resistance, as well as combinations to promote PARP inhibitors to work well. One thing that was notable about some of the findings from the clinical trials that recently led to these FDA approvals showed that while enriched in populations with BRCA mutations, either somatic or germline. They also, response for PARP inhibitors were actually seen in patients who were wild type, and trying to distinguish HR proficient to deficient and how we make that transition over to those patients and try to extend the benefits of inhibitors of DNA damage repair to more patients in our population.
Despite all the excitement surrounding some of the new targeted therapies, standard chemotherapies remain the bedrock of treatment both in the first-line, adjuvant, and recurrent settings of ovarian cancer, said Jason A. Connor, MD, a medical oncologist at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Specifically, he said that platinum doublet chemotherapy remains the cornerstone of treatment for patients with platinum-sensitive recurrent ovarian cancer, just as anthracycline and taxane-based chemotherapy are mainstays for those with platinum-resistant and recurrent disease.
First, we just established the basis for the platinum doublets, looking at the trials combining paclitaxel and gemcitabine with carboplatin, being superior to carboplatin by itself. Then furthermore, looking at the head-to-head doublet in the Calypso study of carboplatin and liposomal doxorubicin compared with Taxol and carboplatin. Furthermore, we're going to review the trials that established bevacizumab in conjunction with chemotherapy in the treatment of platinum-sensitive recurrence, both with Taxol and carboplatin, and with gemcitabine and carboplatin in the GOG-213 in the OCEAN study, respectively. And we're going to touch upon some of the recent European data looking at carboplatin and liposomal doxorubicin in combination with bevacizumab, and the interesting results when compared with the OCEANS trial. We'll also be talking about the desktop 3 results and the GOG-213 data as they pertain to secondary surgical cytoreduction. Despite all of the excitement about some of the new targeted therapies, standard chemotherapies remain the bedrock of treatment, both in the first-line adjuvant setting for ovarian cancer and for the recurrent setting. The standards of care all wrap around these platinum doublets until platinum-resistant recurrence develops, and then we talk about some non-platinum therapies. So we'll be talking about two phase 3 trials. One is the AURELIA study, which is the study on which the current FDA approval for bevacizumab in the platinum-resistant recurrent setting applies. And in addition, we'll be mentioning the FORWARD-1 trial, which recently resulted, talking about a folate receptor alpha-targeted antibody-drug conjugate.
In advanced ovarian cancer, initial interest with immunotherapy focused on single-agent PD-1 and PD-L1 blockade. Due to disappointing activity, however, investigators have turned to the use of combination strategies with chemotherapy, angiogenesis agents, and PARP inhibition with some success, said Dimitri Zamarin, MD, PhD, a medical oncologist at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. When we spoke with Zamarin, he explained that inter- and intra-tumor heterogeneity poses a unique challenge to the modality's integration in ovarian cancer care. Despite this, he said that research continues to explore synergistic strategies with the hope of bringing the modality into the clinic.
There have been a number of studies utilizing various immunotherapies, namely immune checkpoint inhibitors in ovarian cancer across all stages, meaning newly diagnosed cancer and advanced. Most of the studies have primarily been done, at least the studies that have been resulted, have been done in the advanced platinum-resistant setting. And there, the response rates that we have seen so far have been rather disappointing. While initially there was enthusiasm for these drugs, at least to date, the single agent PD-1 and PD-L1 inhibitors have a response rate of approximately 9 to 10% across all patients. We still don't have a good biomarker to find out who these patients are who are responding versus the ones that do not. And of course, even if we do get the best possible biomarker, there will still be another 90% of the patients that are in need of better therapies, meaning different types of combinations. So the most natural combination to try to combine it with is chemotherapy. That's the one that's most readily available. We already have very good data from lung cancer trials demonstrating that combination of immunotherapy such as pembrolizumab with chemotherapy in the upfront setting can improve survival. So a number of studies are exploring this concept in ovarian cancer, again, both in the newly diagnosed and the recurrent setting. There have been some negative trials reported to date with that, unfortunately. The Avelumab 200 study, which is a study of liposomal doxorubicin in combination with PD-L1 inhibitor Avelumab. This is the Javelin 200 study that was reported to be negative for its primary endpoint. Similarly, combination of the same drug, Avelumab, in the upfront setting, carboplatin and paclitaxel, also did not seem to meet the primary endpoint of the trial, although we're still awaiting the exact details of these numbers. This does not mean that immunotherapy does not work with chemotherapy. It may mean that we may need other types of combinations. We may need to use it with the different types of chemotherapies than the ones that were evaluated. And, you know, there has been an explosion of a number of other trials using immune checkpoint inhibitors, again, namely PD-1 inhibitors in both upfront and the recurrent setting, now in combination with chemotherapy, bevacizumab, PARP inhibitors in combination with bevacizumab and PARP inhibitors in maintenance. So there are quite a few studies that are currently ongoing to try to address these questions. And it is likely that a combination of multiple drugs will be needed to achieve this efficacy of immunotherapy in ovarian cancer patients. So unfortunately, again, these data are still too early. So most of the negative trials that have been reported to date have not even been presented in any form in the meetings or papers. So we're still waiting for these data. What we're hoping for is that even with negative data, we'd still be able to derive some perhaps biomarkers from these trials. For example, does HRD or BRCA status predict for better or worse response from immunotherapy? Or is there an overall survival benefit despite having no progression-free survival benefit, as we often see in these trials? And I think that will be an important point for us to understand once we see what the data actually are.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to the 44th episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science summits. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. We have several upcoming State of the Science summits for those interested in attending. If you'd like to hear more about the treatment landscape of breast cancer, consider registering for the June 19th State of the Science Summit in Atlanta, Georgia. We will also be hosting a State of the Science Summit on June 26th in Tampa, Florida, which is focused on ovarian cancer. To check out the list of upcoming meetings or to register, go to onclive.com/meetings/SOSS. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at @OncLive and @OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.